Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. We all have friends that we still speak to, against our better judgment, that are a little questionable. Characters that make it difficult to desert, or they bring a little pizzazz into our lives, something to talk about, have a laugh about the absurdity of their behavior with, and as a result, the absurdity of life in general. It's nice, sometimes, to spend time with someone who simply doesn't give a care. Though, things inevitably get a little rocky with these types, and you have to go. That is, if they'll let you. Welcome to Dark Topic, I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. Gary on the Rocks. Gary Charles Evans was born October 7th, 1954, in the Capital District that surrounds Albany, New York. And seeing how that description of his birthplace makes him seem like some sort of nobility, I'll share now that he was a short king from the start. Gary had an older half-sister, Robbie, from his mother's first marriage. Robbie's father had left the picture to join the carnival. If he had stuck around, then certainly Gary would have been born a completely different person, perhaps even a taller one, with fewer anger issues. Gary's own father, Roy Evans, ruled the house with a fistful of beer bottle. The Evans family lived on the ground floor of a three-story red-bricked apartment building which had one of those monument-like concrete stairways leading to the front door from the sidewalk. Gary was close to his sister Robbie, and they stayed close through childhood into adulthood. Sister Robbie would later recall getting out of the house often with her little brother Gary to escape the craziness of the house. "We would just sit on the front porch and eat fudgicles and drink RC Cola. We'd play games in the alleyway." Some of that craziness was typical of a drunken household, but the behavior of their mother at times went beyond the pale. Ale. Gary's mother, Flora May, became suicidal after her husband got into a drunken car accident while not wearing his seatbelt. Roy flew through the windshield and woke up in hospital. He was able to stumble away with his life, though that life was going to be a little more difficult going forward. Still into the drink, Roy was now into having seizures as well. Or at least it seemed he was into them, because those could have been avoided, those seizures, had he been able to avoid mixing alcohol with his post-accident med regime. With Gary's father now barely able to hold up his head, let alone hold down a job, Mom had a lot of pressure on her. This led to her own drinking and eventually the attempted suicides. One of these attempts, she was in her bedroom, supposedly cleaning a hunting rifle. Gary was riding his tricycle in the hallway. He was three. And I'm not sure which came first, Gary falling off his bike and crying after he heard a gunshot, or his mother Flora May getting distracted by his cries just as she went to shoot herself and missing her mark. Robbie ran to her and found her lying on her bed with blood sprayed all over the room. His mother Flora May had put the gun to her chest but misfired and nearly blew her shoulder off. In the end, the incident was ruled an accident. Another incident had Flora May standing on the roof of a three-story building threatening to jump. She also stood on railroad tracks, waiting for a train to hit her, but then stepped out before the train could actually do that. She had permanent scars on her wrists from trying to kill herself so many times. Flora May and her husband Roy, Gary's father, struggled to keep food on the table and the alcohol flowing at the same time. With Roy out of work, though collecting disability after the accident, most things fell on Flora May, including him when he'd have one of his seizures. She worked odd jobs to try to make ends meet, and life soon manifested in anger, resentment, and violence. Gary would later claim that he utterly despised his mother and father, and spoke of a childhood prevalent with violence and abuse of all kinds. My father did things to me that I wouldn't wish on anyone. He also told friends that his mother had abused him sexually for years, along with his father. A babysitter of Gary and his sister would later recall young Gary Evans as being a quiet child. This wasn't for lack of having anything to say. He was an intelligent kid, and that may be why he was so quiet. Gary was processing his predicament, careful not to share too much of himself for fear of being taken advantage of. He was small, picked on at school, and at home. And now, decades later on this podcast, though you know me, I'd say it to his face. You know, we'd be good. Me and Gary would be happy with it. We'd be joking around, palling around a bit, I think, until he started killing all the people, right? This babysitter lived next door to the Evans family. She would often chat with the little boy from the alley separating their homes. Gary was always in his room overlooking this alleyway. He was in there for misbehavior, just for any indiscretion. He was claiming later that he was in there because he'd been abused and his father wanted to shut him down for a while to cool off after the abuse so that maybe he wouldn't go running and tell somebody about it. He hated eating liver, which was often served at the dinner table of the Evans since it was cheaper than other cuts. When he refused to eat liver, his father would shove it down his throat. He'd also beat him with a leather strap and then throw him into his room with no dinner. This babysitter recalled feeding Gary cereal and chocolate chip cookies through his window from the alleyway at times. A sweet, yet sad story. The whole childhood of Gary Charles Evans is like this. He rarely was allowed to watch TV with the family. He was almost always in his room. So he would lie on his floor and try to watch from under the door while everyone else sat and enjoyed it. He confided in a friend when he was young that his mother would take him to the doctor's office, where he would wait outside the office and hear his mother having sex with the doctor. They say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. At the age of 8, Gary had sex with his doctor. No, I'm sorry, that's not funny at all. Gary brought home a $1,000 ring he had stolen while he was out with his mother. She was using him to steal stuff for her, knowing that he couldn't get in much trouble if he were caught at the age of 8. Flora May was also a thief, and she had taught him. This would become an addiction of Gary's stealing. As his career as a thief began, he developed a kind of Robin Hood style, stealing from people he thought deserved it, like local drug dealers or other criminal types. He never really considered himself a bad guy. As Gary got older, he wasn't the little boy that his father could manhandle, and his arms and legs ballooned. He didn't have to really work at it. He just got big and buff naturally. Not surprisingly, Gary was a bully, throwing rocks at the neighborhood kids or just beating them up. A true sign of the serial killer Evans would later become, he was mean to small animals and liked to light fires. He would target cats. He tied one by its tail to something and lit it on fire. A real piece of shit. When he reached an age where he could finally be out on his own, he lived in abandoned buildings and slept in abandoned cars and trucks, eating what food he could scrounge or steal. Gary was a loner, traveled by himself, and worked by himself, as he felt people pissed him off and let him down, mostly. Living on the streets for much of the summer of 1970, he became involved in petty larceny and even spent 90 days in a county jail after being caught breaking into a house. The sheriff that arrested him, trying to help Gary, got him a job digging graves in a local cemetery after he got out of jail. He lasted only a few days doing this job, but did steal some tombstones and managed to sell them for cheap. Evans was learning that just about anything could be sold, including his soul. By the mid-1970s, Gary had connected with two old neighborhood guys. Now, I wouldn't call them friends, but just guys from the old neighborhood. Tim Reisendorf and Michael Falco. He ended up sharing an apartment on Adams Street in Troy, New York State, just a few blocks from Gary's childhood home. Tim Reisendorf was described as a good kid growing up until he fell in with the wrong group of friends. Michael Falco had a reputation as a troublemaker who was always in the wrong place at the wrong time, apparently. His troubles with the law didn't start until he met Gary, same with Tim. Gary was 4 years older than Michael, and they didn't hang around together much as kids, but they did know each other, probably through Tim, Gary, now in his 20s, at only 5'6", became a rather large, muscular man and began lifting weights obsessively. He had a wrestler's build, and many would compliment him on this build. They weren't focused so much on his shortness. He's 5'6". They would focus more on his muscles, and he liked that. He had to keep up that build in order to keep up the compliments and keep up the fear of other people of him, who would not make fun of him for being short, as he had been all through his childhood. He grew a long, wiry beard. He wore bandanas. He had large Elvis-like sunglasses and had hair down to his shoulders. No longer interested in small-time thefts, he spent his time studying antiques, reading books, browsing antique stores, pricing items, and learning about expensive artwork and rare prints. He was all about the big-ticket items, thinking if he was going to get caught, it was going to be well worth his effort. Gary was pulling off burglaries and robberies with Michael and Tim. While in what he would later call a learning curve, he burglarized a home in Lake Placid, New York, got caught, and was sentenced to 4 years in a state prison, getting his first taste of hard time in Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York. This would be the first of almost 24 serious arrests and several prison bids. And you hear that train a-calling. It's rolling round the bend. And I ain't seen my baby since I don't know when, man. I'm stuck in Dannemora, New York State, and I'm like 5'6". If I give this dude a blowjob, he might give me a Twix. All right. Being locked up in prison scared Gary Evans, and the main focus of his fear came from doing time with whom he referred to as those people. That is, any non-white, non-straight inmate, which, let's be honest, isn't hard to bump into while in prison. Gary Evans harbored such a hatred for African Americans that he couldn't even look at a black person without saying something hurtful and claiming, quote, "They're wasting my oxygen." No doubt this seed of hatred had been planted by his father, who was an admitted racist. 6 months into his sentence, his father, at age 55, lost his battle with throat cancer and died. Probably from talking so much shit, am I right? Midway through his sentence, he was transferred to Great Meadow Correctional Facility. Great Meadow was a facility that helped inmates get an education and deal with their social and mental problems. Being transferred to Great Meadow meant Gary was on his way to freedom. On March 31st of 1980, he was back on the streets after having served 2 years of his 4-year sentence, and he wasted no time getting back to his old habits. Burglary was all he knew. He went back to living with Michael and Tim. Gary and Michael Falco would commit robberies and use the apartment they lived in to store their stolen property. Timothy was new to this line of work and focused more on his music. He had never planned any of the crimes and just went along for the ride with Falco and Evans. At times, he just wanted to make a little extra cash. He's one of those guys who tags along, maybe does the driving. Gary and Falco were in a routine, stealing and fencing stolen property daily. When they weren't stealing, they were planning the next heist. In the spring of 1980, Gary Evans was caught with a few $100s of stolen property from an antique store. He was on parole, so he was sent back to prison to await a court hearing to decide where he would serve the remainder of his previous sentence and any additional time for this most recent possession charge. The way it would work is that if you get caught while you're on parole and you were let out early, you have to serve the rest of that previous sentence, apparently. Old Rensselaer County Jail was where he was being held, and it was like living in a dormitory, which Gary Evans could handle, and within days, he made friends with several members of the Hell's Angels. He looked like a biker already, and it was easy enough for him to get involved. He was also super racist. Not that they all are, but, you know, it helps. I know that Hell's Angels are great guys that hand out toys to kids at Christmas and, you know, turkeys, Thanksgiving. But for the most part, Hell's Angels are not angels. June 12th, 1980. Gary came up with the idea of getting together enough Hell's Angels who were large men to hoist them up over a fence in the courtyard where the guards weren't watching. Waiting for the right moment, at 10:30 a.m., a couple of angels started fighting at the north side of the yard, while two others, swinging Gary back and forth by his hands and feet a few times, heaved him over the fence like he was a sack of potatoes. And just like that, Gary Evans was on the other side of the fence, a free man. It wasn't until roll call later that morning that he was discovered missing. Law enforcement started searching the area, and about 5 hours later, he was spotted in the Troy Public Library, where police responded and soon chased him out a third-story window and out onto a stone ledge of the old structure. "I'm not coming down," he yelled. After an hour-long standoff, authorities were able to wrestle him through the window and back to the county jail, where he was put in solitary confinement. On September the 11th of 1980, Gary Evans's parole was revoked and he was sentenced to another 2 to 4 years at Clinton Correctional for second-degree possession of stolen goods and first-degree escape. This is when he began writing to his sister Robbie, who was now living in Florida. At first he wrote to complain about not being able to practice martial arts. Hi-ya! No stretching or kicking was allowed in prison. And he also talked about revenge against people who helped put him away. He never spoke about having any responsibility for his crimes. It was always somebody else's fault, and enemy number one was now Michael Falco, whom he suspected of being a rat. March 19th of 1982, Evans was up for parole again. The board denied him due to this being his second incarceration while on parole and suggested he see a counselor to deal with his antisocial behavior. September 12th of 1982, the DOC, knowing Evans was due for parole in a few months, transferred him to Attica State Prison. This is one of New York's most feared prisons, where the worst of the worst are locked up. Serial murderers, rapists, child killers, mobsters, deviant sexual predators, and just basically high-profile criminals were housed there. The thinking was a few months there for Gary Evans, before he was eventually released, would hopefully teach him a lesson. His letters to his sister Robbie continued to talk about revenge when he got out and that he has a shit list. In one letter he wrote, quote, "I don't think I can manage them all, but the important ones will definitely see my smiling face some dark night, and there's going to be some screaming, begging, crying snake bastards when that time comes. I feel like making headlines as a vampire murderer. I feel like filling up a private graveyard. Just 6.5 months to go." End quote. His last letter to his sister from prison read, "I have thought more often of just leaving the assholes I don't like alone. Not all of them, but most of them. I'll just leave them to their shitty lives. I have to have a couple of them, though." End quote. Back on the streets on December 29th, 1982, Evans began looking up old friends, specifically Michael Falco. Within weeks of hooking back up, they pulled a few small jobs together and then parted ways. Gary Evans went to Florida to his sister's home. They received word that their mother, who had been happy in a lesbian relationship that Gary hated and thought was super gay, heard that she had passed away. The way that she had passed away, I'm glad I got the laughing out of the way here because this is no laughing matter. His mother had been leaving a bar when she slipped on ice getting into her car. She was knocked unconscious after hitting her head and ended up freezing to death in the parking lot. And when it comes to drunks, that's known as dying of natural causes. And that's a joke. Gary Evans might have appreciated. He never drank or smoked and had a healthy hatred for those who lived that lifestyle. Did I mention he was a vegetarian? Having liver shoved down your throat as a boy will do that. Evans was glad his folks were both dead. Mom had been a mess and Dad had messed him up. Shoving more than liver down his throat Dad had, if you believe Gary Evans, and this could be where he got both his racism and homophobia. And damn, kind of makes you think, eh? It really does matter how you raise your kids. On a serious note, it really does. In the spring of 1983, Gary Evans went back to live in Troy, New York State, and started thinking about what his future would look like. He didn't want a real job and knew he could make quick money burglarizing homes, businesses, antique shops, and jewelry stores. Once he had enough money, he would go see the world, which meant going out of New York State, you know, maybe back to Florida, could hit California at some point. He's not allowed out of the country, but to many people who live in certain countries, they think the whole world revolves around that country, so he's not entirely wrong. And first, he had some loose ends to clear up. Gary Evans had found out that a few Hell's Angels had beat up a judge's son real bad. The DA encouraged him to testify before a grand jury to help put them away. Gary Evans never did anything without there being something in it for him. The DA promised to drop some charges he was facing in exchange for his testimony. Word in the streets traveled fast, and he developed a reputation for being an informant. The very thing he'd accused his partners of doing, he was now doing himself. Gary Evans went back to living with the man he hated and Michael Falco and the man he was suspicious of and Tim Reisendorf, but this run with them wouldn't last long. In April, he got picked up for burglarizing a home. The DA paid him a visit to fish for any new outlaw biker-centric information. It seemed that Gary Evans was developing a death wish as he took the bait eagerly, claiming he didn't care if he was found out. It's possible he had begun despising himself for becoming an informant. On September 16th of 1984, Evans was released early on good behavior, or as he no doubt saw it, for being a good little rat. He was a free man and no longer on parole, though on his record there were 2 felony charge convictions, and a 3rd would brand him as a persistent felon, which would force him to face 25 years to life or death. Now he was a known informant on the Hell's Angels. They threw him over the fence, and he threw them under the bus. His beard was down to his nipples, hot. The bandana was super tight to cover his balding, and he was juiced to the gills. A muscle hamster, as they say. Nobody wanted to mess with this newest version of Gary Evans. He was bad to the bone and had taken on a new motto: no partners. New York State's town of Brunswick, population 12,000, became his new target town, as most residents didn't have alarms in their homes, making breaking and entering easy. In Brunswick, he could do small-time jobs that eventually would finance the bigger jobs he dreamt about. Evans would scour parking lots of 5-star restaurants, jewelry stores, and antique shops, looking for luxury cars. When he found one of interest, he would see if they had their garage door opener clipped to the visor. Then he'd break into the car, steal the garage door opener, and check the glove compartment for their registration to get an address. Then he would drive his vehicle to that home and burglarize it, opening the garage to access the house with the garage door opener. He knew the occupants were out shopping or eating. It was a slick scheme, the only kind that Evans seemed to come up with, and probably had something to do with his difficult childhood paired with an often impressive intellect. On that note, I should share that on many of his arrests, it was documented that Gary Evans had in his possession a handcuff key. Later, when asked why he carried handcuff keys, Evans said, quote, "I was handcuffed long before I was ever arrested," end quote. And as I rudely alluded to earlier, Gary Evans was abused brutally growing up and claimed that his father would handcuff him in the basement and savagely molest him. He spent a lot of time enslaved, hidden away as a boy. Prison stints were triggering, and he was hell-bent on staying out of prison. Sticking to his no-partners motto became difficult when Evans began living with his childhood friends Michael Falco and Tim Reisendorf again, and in February 1985, a friend of Evans told him about a flea market in East Greenbush, New York, where there would be a lot of gold and valuables. Evans asked Damian Cuomo, a known thief and someone he had just met, if the flea market would be worth the effort. Cuomo said it would be, as it was set back from the road and no one would be around at night, and that the dealers there, they left their merchandise in the building overnight on the weekends. Evans went to Michael Falco and asked him if he wanted to help him with this job. Falco was likely eager to please Evans, as he knew of his burly, mentally unstable buddy's suspicion on him being a rat. After casing the flea market, Evans and Falco realized they could get in and out quickly, taking plenty of gold with them, likely. On February the 16th of 1985, at about 11 p.m., he and Falco loaded Falco's Plymouth Satellite with a rope ladder, burglary tools, and 2 empty duffel bags, then headed for the East Greenbush Plaza flea market. They pulled around back and parked. Evans noticed a portable toilet that they used to get on the roof, and after finding a hatch door, they got into the flea market. They hung the rope ladder as they made their way in. Staring at $30,000 worth of merchandise, they filled 2 duffel bags and left the same way they came in. They drove slowly out from behind the building and saw a cop making his rounds. The cop hit his lights and stopped them, asking what they were up to. They explained they had stopped to take a piss. They had hid their stash in the side panels of the back seat of the car so nothing was in sight, and the cop, taking the word for it, let them go, but took down their names and addresses before allowing this. The next morning, the owner of the flea market called police after noticing they had been broken into. All investigators had were 2 sets of footprints leading to a set of tire tracks out back. A few days later, the officer that had stopped them notified state police, and a teletype went out to the Bureau looking to question Evans and Falco. About a week later, Timothy told Evans that while he had been in jail, Michael Falco had ripped him off by taking some of their jewelry they had hidden under the floorboards in their apartment. In reality, it's believed that Timothy Reisendorf had taken the jewelry himself and, realizing that Evans was very dangerous by this point, wanted to make sure he kept the wrath of Evans away from him. The next time Gary Evans saw Michael Falco, he confronted him about it, offering him a chance to confess, which turned into an argument, the situation. They had been loading clothes into Tim Reisendorf's car, and as Michael Falco leaned in to put a box into the trunk, Gary Evans placed the barrel of a .22 caliber pistol to the back of his head and shot him dead. He then pushed his body into the trunk and ran to get Reisendorf. "Come with me, man, I need your help," he said to Tim as he grabbed a sleeping bag. They went to the car, and Evans opened the trunk. "What the fuck?" Tim yelled, looking away. "You shut your mouth, or you're fucking next." Evans would later admit as soon as Tim told him that Falco was stealing from him, he started planning Falco's death. It was never a spur-of-the-moment crime, and he knew he was going to use Tim Reisendorf's car to dispose of the body to implicate him. With Falco's body wrapped in a sleeping bag in the trunk, Evans took off for Lake Worth, Florida, where his sister Robbie lived. And I feel like a rat telling this story. I feel like I'm talking about my uncle or something. And I'm just letting you guys all know, you know, what I heard around the dinner table. This is a little bit of a different dark topic. It's a guy I've been looking at for a long time. Gary Charles Evans. Super interesting thief. Turned murderer. Not your typical serial killer I would cover, climbing in through windows and raping women, as I so enjoy normally. And I'm joking, by the way, to all the people fucking leaving comments saying I'm a psychopath. I can take a joke, for Christ's sakes. Trying to lighten the mood here. Joking about women getting raped. I mean, come on. No one else finds that funny when I do that? So on the way to Florida with the dead body in the trunk, Evans would end up stopping near the woods and camp about 200 yards away from the highway in deep brush. If by chance cops searched his vehicle while he was sleeping, they would trace it back to Tim Reisendorf. It was all part of the plan, and he could take off into the woods. He buried Falco's body in a swamp only miles from his sister Robbie's house. Thinking he should lay low for a while, he went to visit his sister, nephew, and her new husband, staying for about 6 weeks before heading back to New York. Sometime later, Evans, he ran into a woman that he, Reisendorf, and Falco knew, and as they were talking, he noticed she was wearing one of the missing pieces of the jewelry that apparently Falco had stolen. He complimented her on the piece of jewelry, hoping for more information, and he got it when she looked down at it and said, "Yeah, it's beautiful. Tim gave it to me." Now remember, Tim Reisendorf is the one who told Evans that Falco had been stealing jewelry. And he says to himself, "Motherfucker, I told myself no partners." No partners Gary Evans was now going to be sure of. On April 21st of 1985, Gary Evans hatched his latest plan. He managed to convince a local drug dealer that he had stolen some marijuana from another dealer and wanted to get rid of it. This dealer offered him $12,000 for it, and they planned to meet up in a downtown parking lot. The dealer showed Evans the money. Evans took it and told that dealer and his friend there, "We have to do this fast. It's in my trunk." When the two men got out and walked over to Evans' Saab, he took off down a nearby alleyway. The two dealers chased Evans, even firing several shots at him as he ran away. If anyone knew the neighborhood, alleyways and hiding places, it was Gary Evans. He ran through gangways and backyards, ending back at the parking lot, and he managed to lose both drug dealers in this circular escape. He stood looking at their brand new car. He was thinking about getting into his Saab, but he's like, "Oh shit, their brand new car's here and it's running still." So he hopped into it and took off in it. The dealers walked to the police department and told them they picked up Evans hitchhiking and that he had hijacked them at gunpoint. Pulling into town, Gary Evans ran a red light. A police officer saw him and tried to pull him over. Thinking he was being chased for the robbery, Gary panicked and tried to outrun them. As he sped through town, he started throwing his fake ID, his gun, and anything else that could be used against him out the window. After being cornered, he stopped and gave himself up. Police retraced the route and found the gun and his fake ID while in custody awaiting arraignment on several charges, his name turned up as wanted in questioning for the burglary in East Greenbush, the flea market job. This would result in the first written confession Gary Evans ever gave to the police. He described in detail how the job was planned, who was involved, and how it had been carried out, speaking as though he relished betraying his colleague, Michael Falco, whom he hadn't heard from in months. A key character and one whom Evans grew to trust somewhat, Detective Horton, asked Evans about his missing friend. Quote, "I think he's in California, using the name Ian Patrick Vibes." Gary Evans was then waiting for trial, and he was facing several charges, and he believed that by cooperating with the state police, some of them, those charges would be dropped, sparing him from a potential third strike, a 25 to life sentence. By July, Evans was sentenced to another 2 to 4 years because of his rat job here. And he, by the summer of 1985, was talking to Detective Horton further and helped him track down Falco's common-law wife, Tori Ellis, the mother of Falco's kids. She was under the impression that Falco had taken off to California after hearing from several people who had heard from Gary Evans that this is what had happened to him. She ended up turning over several pieces of jewelry from the Greenbush flea market job that Falco had given her. By late August, Evans was on his way to serve his time at Sing Sing Correctional Facility, a notorious New York prison, despite his attempts to pin much of his crime on Falco, whom he had murdered to this point. Movies have been shot there at Sing Sing, books written about it, and some of the notable prisoners of the time were locked up there in the New York area. To Evans, this was a feather to add to his criminal hat, and he felt he would earn some respect having spent time there, so he was kind of looking forward to it. Another feather would be his friendship with David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, the most famous, most infamous person he had met while in prison to this point. At first, he would stay clear of Berkowitz, but eventually they would lift weights together. Despite his crimes, Evans described him, David Berkowitz, as a likable guy, really. And if you don't know who David Berkowitz is, he's the son of Sam Killer. Just, you know, firing on people in their vehicles. You know who this guy is. These days, you could see interviews with him. He's a born-again Christian, and I don't know, man. There's something in his eyes that makes me feel that he's still a little devilish. But Gary felt important to this man, David Berkowitz, would end up sharing stories with him. He was great for Gary's ego, always complimenting him on his muscles and even nicknamed him, Gary Evans, the Great Tricep King. Their relationship ended when Evans called David Berkowitz David Berserkowitz one day while working out. Some think their relationship ended because they were in a sexual relationship and something went on there, but calling him David Berserkowitz hit son of Sam the wrong way. In an article that Gary Evans had read about David Berkowitz, it was said that he was adopted, and it freaked him out when he realized that his birth name was Richard Falco. How serendipitous, him knowing that he had killed his friend Michael Falco to this point. By December, Evans was transferred to Dannemora, which didn't sit well with him. He didn't want to go back there. What angered him most was that he was placed in a cell next to one he occupied back in 1977. Having spent most of his 20s behind bars at that time, he didn't like being back here, and this close to those memories. Detective Horton continued to search and follow up on leads about Michael Falco, having no idea he was wrapped in a sleeping bag and buried in a shallow grave in Florida by his main man here, his main snitch in Evans. He began... Detective Horton did, to believe he was either extremely good at hiding out was Falco, or something was keeping him from contacting anyone, you know, maybe being dead. And Detective Horton promised himself he was going to find Falco for his wife, and not his own wife, but for Falco's wife and for Falco's children. Born on September 10th, 1961, Damian Cuomo, whom I mentioned, was 7 years younger than Evans. He had heard of Evans and had run into him once in a while, but never considered working with him. Evans was known as a good thief, small at 5'6", so he can climb in his shit, super strong, so he could scale walls and fences like a cat. Cuomo lived on Industrial Park Road in Troy, New York State, with his longtime girlfriend Lisa Morris and their daughter Christina. When Evans and Cuomo had hooked up in 1988, one afternoon Gary Evans had just showed up at his door looking for him. Lisa was home alone and had never seen Evans before, nor had Cuomo talked about Gary Evans. And she came to realize after everything went down that Evans was always pulling Cuomo, Damian Cuomo, out of the house and taking him for long hours out and to do things that they said were just normal shit, like going golfing or bowling, you know, like dudes do, going on dates together. In reality, they were out burglarizing the area. Lisa didn't like Gary Evans for taking her husband away from her and the kids. Her hatred for Gary Evans grew after they had words one afternoon. And Gary Evans threatened to, quote, "I'll throw you off a balcony if you give me any more trouble, bitch," end quote. Over the next few years, Gary and Damian became inseparable. They hung out together and committed burglaries together and were very successful. In the meantime, Gary Evans would stay in contact with Detective Horton and told the detective he could set up a sting to buy stolen weapons from a local Troy burglar. "What do you want for this, Gary?" Horton had asked. "Nothing. I just want to fuck this guy hard," said Gary Evans. And not sure what he meant by that. I do know what he meant by that. He just wants to fuck him up, you know, fuck his life up. He doesn't literally want to fuck him because that would be gay. The next day, with Gary's help, Detective Horton had stolen weapons off the streets and a burglar in jail. Gary Evans needed to stay in touch with Detective Horton because this was his way out of certain situations. He'd offer his help constantly. It was just all a scheme, though. He was getting ahead, buying his trust, giving him information on people in case he got in trouble in the future. It was no shock to Detective Horton when he got a call letting him know that Gary Evans and his partner were in lockup after being pulled over for speeding, and on them they had burglar-style tools. Little did Detective Horton know that Evans and Cuomo had the entire inside of Cuomo's car lined with stolen merchandise, but the cops never found it. The fall of 1989 was beautiful in Watertown, New York. Situated in the northern part of the state, it was just over 200 miles, a 3.5-hour drive from Albany. Crime in Watertown is something the residents worried little about at the time. A friend of Damian Cuomo's told him there was a small coin and jewelry shop in town that could be an easy target for him. 63-year-old Douglas Berry, owner and operator of the Square Lion Coin and Jewelry, was an unassuming businessman who opened his shop in the mid-70s. He couldn't afford an alarm system, and he occasionally slept in a loft at the back of the shop with a handgun under his pillow for protection. He worked long hours, ran the shop by himself, liked to stay away from his wife at night, you know, drink and fall asleep. Damian Cuomo was excited about the job, but Gary Evans, who never took things at face value, decided they should go up there and take a look before doing anything. He wanted to be certain the information was solid and be sure they weren't being set up. Throughout the summer, they drove to Watertown several times to check out the Square Lion, and they even went into the shop and sold Barry a few pieces of gold they had stolen. They also made a trip to the Canadian border, where Cuomo purchased some Canadian cigarettes, and Gary Evans bought snacks and other items like Twix, Mirage bars, what do we got here, Smarties that they don't have in the States, that he would use later to spread around scenes to make it seem like a Canadian had done it and not someone from the States. Always the thinker, that little stinker, Gary Evans. Sitting in Cuomo's car in the parking lot, they waited for Barry to lock up and turn off the lights of his little pawn shop here. Gary Evans, staring at the building, had a feeling that Barry would leave the windows unlocked. He usually closed his shop at 6 p.m., and for some reason, he still had the lights on by 9 p.m. At about midnight, Barry came in and walked up the street to a Mr. Sub, very Canadian, sub place. He chatted with the girl behind the counter, and after about 20 minutes, left with his sandwich. Obviously, Barry wasn't going to sleep anytime soon because he got to eat that big old sub. So Evans and Cuomo went to get something to eat, too, at Mr. Sub. At about 4:30 a.m., Gary decides that Barry had been asleep long enough for them to get in without being heard. The window was left unlocked, as Evans thought. Gary Evans entered first, then Damian Cuomo followed. Evans snuck up behind Barry while he slept and knelt behind him with his .22 caliber pistol pointed at his head and waited while Cuomo walked around with a duffel bag, filling it with jewelry, gold coins, and rare baseball cards. Cuomo tried desperately to keep quiet because he knew that his partner here in Gary Evans would kill this shop owner in Barry if he was awoken. The floorboards, though, were squeaking and creaking underneath his feet as he stole items. Barry began to stir in his chair, gun to the back of his head, but didn't wake up. Cuomo dumped a tray of diamond rings, gold chains, and necklaces into a bag at one point, which startled Barry, and he stirred even more. When Cuomo dumped another bag, Barry woke up and began looking around. Huh? Huh? When Gary saw this, he shot him in the head. There was no blood. Barry just simply fell back down on the pillow as if he had been knocked unconscious. It seemed that the bullet from the .22 caliber pistol that he had, the bullet had just knocked around his brain and stayed in there. The only blood spilling was from the entrance hole to the back of his head, which was kind of cool. Gary Evans thought that was a neat one. Cuomo heard a pop, rushed to the loft and asked, "What the fuck was that?" Evans looked him in the eyes and simply said, "Are you finished? Because this fucker is." "No, there's more. There's more shit to steal." "Well, fuck it. We're leaving right now. I just killed him." By the time they were finished, it was daylight outside. Before Cuomo left, they took cigarettes out of the bag and crumpled them up and threw them near the body to like a red herring. Canadian cigarettes, of course. With over $30,000 worth of merchandise, they drove to Troy, New York, without a problem. Once they got back to Troy, they agreed to meet up in 3 days, and they separated at that point. Cuomo would hold on to the goods, as he had someone that would buy most of it. The next morning, Shirley Barry, Douglas Barry's wife, decided to drive to the shop when her husband failed to answer the phone, which was odd. Yeah, he'd often, you know, fall asleep in the pawn shop and kind of guard it with his gun, but almost every single day he would be up early and having his coffee and getting ready to start up. So when she got to the shop, she entered with her key and she immediately notices a few of the jewelry cases open and items missing. She calls out for her husband up in the loft. She goes up, hearing nothing from him, finds him seemingly still asleep. When she goes to shake him, blood seeps out of the back of his head in a blurp, blurp. Investigator Keith Fairchild interviewed Shirley. The medical examiner and other local officers could come up with only a .22 caliber spent projectile that was found near Barry's head, a casing by his elbow, and a crumpled pack of Canadian cigarettes, along with a size 10 footprint found pressed into the carpet and blood. One trick that Gary Evans used to use was to wear shoes two sizes too big. So they're looking for a bigger man. Gary Evans and Cuomo met up on September 11th, 1989, a popular date for this case for some reason, in Troy. Cuomo, as promised, sold all the stolen merchandise, and then he handed, at this point, Gary Evans a wad of cash. "There's about 15 grand there," he told Gary. "Not a bad day's work, Damien, huh?" Gary said, smiling. "I guess," Cuomo said. And Cuomo, he was a bit shaky, anxious. He was a burglar, and the idea of killing someone was never part of who he was or what he did, and now he was a part of this. Gary looked at him suspiciously, like, "I don't think this guy's going to be able to handle what I did." He had killed before, and the murder of an innocent man didn't seem to matter to him. "You can never tell anyone about that job. You fucking understand me?" "I know, Gary. I know. I understand." These are the friends that you run into sometimes. Guys who you'll be around, girls, whatever, right? Where you'll be around them and they'll do something fucked up. And now you're a part of it. And they'll look at you. I mean, maybe I'm just speaking for myself. But they'll look at you like, "Hey, we're all in together now on this, right?" And you go, "Yeah. Yeah, we definitely are. Because if I give you the idea that we aren't, I feel that you're going to turn this around on me or turn on me. You know, hurt me, kill me. Do something to fucking make me afraid to ever speak about this ever again." These are the traps of hanging out with questionable people. They can be a lot of fun till they're not. So Gary Evans, in true scumbag fashion, didn't trust his partner in Cuomo, convincing himself that Cuomo had been ripping him off the entire time that he'd known him. And in his mind, he's like, you'll get yours too, you little fucker. I've already killed one of my partners already. I'll kill another. And Evans thought this as he watched Cuomo drive away after giving him his cut, his straight-up cut. By November 1989, Watertown detectives had a suspect in the murder of Douglas Berry, the shop owner, a man with an extensive arrest record in New York and New Jersey who 2 years earlier had bragged about killing Berry and taking all of his gold, came up. And this is hilarious that some criminals will brag about crimes they never did to people who will later use that information against them. When they tracked this guy down, he denied any involvement, so detectives asked him to take a polygraph. He agreed, stating he had nothing to hide, but he ended up failing the test, probably because he had a lot of other things that he was lying about. So in the end, detectives, they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute, and the case was reopened. They were going to take him down on this failed polygraph test, and it appeared that Evans had committed the perfect murder now at this point. He followed the investigation from afar and realized how easy it was to get away with murder. He had killed two men with no consequences. Why not kill more? It was the end of November, just after Thanksgiving, and there was something he needed to do before the first major snowfall of 1989. Gary Evans purchased 3 bags of topsoil and about 9 feet of chicken wire. After grabbing a shovel and saw, he drove into the back of Damian Cuomo's apartment and parked his truck near a wooded area out of view. He walked about a half mile into the woods, looking for an area less accessible. After walking up and down steep inclines and small hills, he located a tree about 4 inches in diameter and began sawing it, and eventually the tree was down to the ground. He's getting a Christmas tree, I think, right here. He then walked north where he was standing, counting off 60 paces, then started digging. He dug through the layer of frost, then dug a 3 foot deep and 3 foot round hole. He lined it with chicken wire so it wouldn't cave in, put 3 bags of topsoil on top of the hole, covered it with a piece of wood he found nearby, and threw mulch and leaves on it to camouflage it. He believed that Cuomo had shorted him on the Watertown job, thinking he sold the merchandise for far more money than he had claimed. He also believed that Cuomo would rat on him in a minute to save himself, as he had a wife and a kid. When Gary Evans made up his mind, facts didn't matter. If he believed Damian Cuomo ripped him off, in his mind he did. And it was now time for Damian to go. On December 26th, the day after Christmas, 1989, Gary Evans called Cuomo and told him he wanted to meet up with him to discuss some things. Lisa, Cuomo's wife, had drank heavily the night before, and she was asleep the morning Evans showed up. Christina, the daughter of Cuomo, little girl, was in the living room watching cartoons. Damian told his daughter, quote, "Tell mommy when she wakes up that daddy will be back in half an hour." And then he left with Evans. "Where are we going?" he asked Gary as they got into his car. "Just up the road here, bro. We need to talk privately." Gary Evans took them to the wooded area, parked, shut off the car. He then took out his .22 cal pistol and pointed it at Damien's temple. "You thieving fuck. You stole from me, and you thought you can get away with it." He then got out of the car, keeping the pistol pointed at Cuomo, as he walked around the front of the car to the passenger side where Cuomo was still sitting. After handcuffing Cuomo's hands behind his back, without saying a word, he shot him 3 times in the back of the head outside the car. He then placed a shopping bag over his head, went to his trunk, pulled out a shower curtain and some rope, wrapped Cuomo in the curtain, and dragged him through the woods to the hole he had already dug. He removed the wood cover and the 3 bags of soil and threw Cuomo in head first. He then covered him with the topsoil, threw some brush over it, and drove home. The tree that he had cut down, just to mention that, was for him to recognize the area, I believe. Not for a Merry Christmas, as I'd hoped. This is a very un-Merry Christmas, though it has just passed, so. In his defense, Gary Evans' defense, at least he allowed Damian Cuomo to have Christmas with his wife and little girl first. Great stuff.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
At about 11 a.m. the next morning, Gary called Damian Cuomo's apartment and his girlfriend Lisa answered. "Where's that fucking weasel boyfriend of yours, Lisa? He's supposed to take me to the airport." "I have no idea." "Well, he's supposed to take me." Lisa cut him off and offered to take him herself. "Nah, fuck it. I called a cab, but you can tell that little fuck when I catch up with him. He owes me." All this while knowing that he had killed Cuomo. Lisa said she would tell him when she saw him and then hung up. Damian Cuomo was known to not stay in one place for very long, so him being gone didn't create any real worry amongst his family and friends. After, in fact, murdering Cuomo, Gary took off to Florida to lay low for a while, and by the end of January, he was back in Troy, New York State. His goal now was to convince Lisa that her boyfriend in Cuomo was still alive and was nothing but a deadbeat dad who took off on his family. "He left you and Christina. He's not coming back." Later, while Lisa was in the hospital for a drug overdose, Gary Evans staged her apartment to look like her boyfriend, missing Damian Cuomo, had been in the apartment, grabbed some of his things, and took off again. When Lisa got out of rehab, she had a Super Bowl Sunday party. And at this party with a few family and friends, including Gary Evans, she, at the end of the night, after everyone had gone, went to bed with Gary. And now Gary Evans is entering territory of evil. I mean, you sometimes gotta kill somebody for the right reasons in his mind, right? Up to this point, the way he was talking, but now he's taking the guy's girl too, and maybe trying to raise the child of a man that he had killed. Gary Evans had a number of women he was sleeping with at any given time, but Lisa became his main squeeze. By the summer of 1990, Evans and Lisa were seeing each other almost daily, and he had even won over Cuomo's child, Christina, by spending time with her, drawing pictures, coloring, playing with her. He started, though, looking over his shoulder quite a bit because word had gotten around that he had probably killed Cuomo and also had killed Michael Falco. Detective Horton, his buddy here, was becoming an experienced investigator in the meantime and was going places in the FBI. Most didn't understand his desire to help rehabilitate Gary Evans, whom he felt was a product of his rough childhood and just needed some direction, a testament to the charm of Gary Evans. Gary would continue to get caught for petty thefts, Detective Horton would fix it, and Gary would continue to offer up information to other criminals for this help to fix it. It was a mutually beneficial arrangement. October 1991, Little Falls, New York. A small town about a 90-minute drive from Albany with a population of about 5,000. In this town, there was a small coin shop on the main street run by 36-year-old Gregory Jubin. Evans loved Jubin's shop as it was far enough away from Albany where he was now staying, and he could come and go into the town without being noticed. He even brought some small items there and got to know Jubin. On October 3rd, Gary began camping out on the roof of the building that housed the coin shop. He was getting low on cash and wanted to scope it out to rob it. At night, shortly before Jubin would close, Gary would watch Jubin by crawling around the ceiling tiles over top of them. He had bored out holes to spy in certain areas, and he wanted to see where he was putting his most valuable items. He eventually saw that it was in a floor safe. He couldn't detect the numbers on that safe from his vantage point. So by the end of the second week, getting frustrated, this was on October 17th, 1991, Gary purchased an open close sign, stuffed it in the front of his pants, put his .22 caliber pistol in a bag secured with duct tape so the bag would catch the shell casings, he's learned this lesson by now, and goes into the shop trying to sell a gold medallion. He enters the shop around 5 p.m. and sees Jubin sitting at his jeweler's desk near the cash register. Evans, he quickly locks the door behind him and puts the close sign in the window. It takes Jubin a few minutes to recognize Evans, then says, "Hey, man, how you been? I'm closing in a few minutes." He hands him the medallion and asks, "Can you check this out for me real quick, guy?" Jubin takes it and sits down at his desk to look at the medallion through his eyepiece. As he lifts the medallion up to the light for a better look, Gary Evans shoots him once in the back of the head. Jubin falls on his desk, his body convulsing and shaking as blood runs down the back of his head. Gary Evans then goes to the door to check if anyone's around or had heard anything. Confident no one did, he shuts off the lights, grabs a handful of diamond rings, and puts them in a duffel bag. He hears Jubin moving at his desk at this point, sees he's trying to reach for a phone. He's not dead. Jubin, struggling to take a breath, lifts the receiver, and Evans puts two more rounds on the side of his head as he does so. Scared he had made too much noise, Gary grabs a few more items and takes off. He makes his way to the rooftop, then jumps over alleyways onto adjacent buildings, and he can hear stuff dropping out of the bag behind him as he does so. He eventually shimmies down a drain pipe and finds himself at his truck he had parked down the block earlier that day. Little Falls Police Department received a call at around 9 p.m. that night. This is October 17th, 1991. Police received the call from Jubin's 77-year-old mother telling them her son failed to come home from work at his usual time, and she had called the shop, but there was no answer. Three Little Falls patrolmen were dispatched. They tried the front door, which was locked. Then they checked the side door that was also locked. They can't figure out how somebody got out, although they don't know that he's able to climb out of the building through the fucking ceiling tiles. Through a window beside the door, they could see Jubin slumped backwards in his desk chair. So they kick in the door, find Jubin's stiff and rigid body with blood all over him and a pool of blood on the floor. And by this time, Constance Jubin had walked in. That's the mother of the deceased here, and says, "Someone killed him. Why did you do this? He's dead. My boy's dead." Evans, Gary Evans, he left Little Falls and returned to Latham to a motel he'd been staying at during this time of this tragedy. The following day, he took a bus to Colorado to meet up with a fence he had used before. His tally from this robbery was just over $60,000. In 1991, that's pretty good money. He returned again to Latham and buried the gun he used to kill Gregory Jubin, along with another gun he had carried on him, in a metal box in the back of the Albany Rural Cemetery. Early in 1993, Evans took off to Vermont to go live in the woods for a while. He had always dreamt of buying land and building a home, but the money he was making off burglaries wasn't enough. There were many antique shops in Vermont he had been eyeing and decided the time was right to pillage them all. After returning to Albany, he kept a low profile, and as the months passed, he started running out of cash again. He's a big spender. He's camped out at the Albany Rural Cemetery near a marble bench, a rare piece of art that weighed about 1,000 pounds. He'd been eyeing the bench and already had a buyer for it. As strong as he was, he knew he couldn't lift it, but managed to get hold of an engine hoist and attach it to the bed of his truck. He had no trouble lifting it without being seen or heard, and within hours was in New York City selling this bench from the graveyard. Unfortunately for Evans, he had sold it to a legitimate antique dealer, and the guy traced the bench back to Albany, the cemetery. Scared he had bought stolen property, this antique dealer called police and gave up Gary Evans right away. Detective Horton was on this case, and he showed up to Evans's apartment and arrested him, knowing that his kind of client here in Evans would be facing serious time. He asked him to help him, Detective Horton, set up an inmate named Jeffrey Williams, who was being held in a waiting trial for the murder of one Carolyn Longsack. As the kids say, pause. She was murdered on January 23rd, 1988. Williams was suspected of this murder, among many other murders and rapes. And Detective Horton was like, "You know what, Gary? We're going to put you in a cell beside this guy and see if he can help us get him to confess. This is how I'll use you this time." On January 10th, 1994, Gary Evans was placed in the cell next to Williams, and within a few days, they were talking regularly and playing chess together. Gary Evans began talking about all of his enemies he would like to take care of when he got out. This kind of talk worked. Williams loosened up, and he started sharing with Evans. Evans asked him if police could get him for the murder that he was charged with. Here's a quote he said. Evans said this is what this Jeffrey Williams, accused of the murder of Carolyn Longsack, said, quote, "I don't think they can get me. They were supposed to think retards killed her." "What the fuck do you mean, retards?" Gary asked. Williams told him that retards that were in the area during that time, he was trying to set them up. But he had driven her out to an area where he killed her, and he said this, "A fucking driver's license. A retard would have left her there. I should have left her there. What's probably going to get me is that I have a driver's license, and I'm trying to blame it on these retards, and the fact she was moved is going to fuck me in the end. this is an admission of guilt. It's nasty. It's fucked up. But this is the way he was talking, not me. So Gary Evans reported this strange information back to Detective Horton, and this information made complete sense to the detective regarding the case. As a reward, Gary Evans was released on February the 12th of 1994, just about a month into his sentence for, you know, this whole caper stealing the bench from the cemetery, which could have put him away for 25 plus years, right? Because of it being a third strike. Detective Horton explained to Gary there would be a trial and he would have to testify. You can't fuck this up, Gary. You can't get in any trouble for this trial. If you show up in leg chains and handcuffs, his attorney will destroy us. And Gary then apparently said, come on, guy. Don't worry about it. Trust me. I know I say guy a lot, but he says guy all the time. Gary Evans, he's a guy guy. Of course, the great tricep king could only be counted on for two things. Staying buff and stealing stuff. In the Norman Williams Public Library was a James Audubon book of rare prints entitled Birds of America. It was worth $100,000 at the time. March 20th, 1994, Evans went around the back of the building and removed the hinge bolts holding the iron bars on one of the basement windows. Within 15 minutes, he was in and out of the library with the 60-pound leather-bound book, Birds of America, in hand. Little did he know that a federal judge sat on the board of trustees for the library in the area. The judge literally made a federal case out of it. And they set up a sting operation to get Gary Evans after an informant had implicated him. Rats on rats. The FBI contacted Detective Norton, asking for his help. They knew he was very close to Gary. After waiting patiently for Evans to contact him, Horton was happy that Gary eventually did. Gary said, hey man, I know I fucked up. And Detective Horton's like, you screwed me. You promised me you wouldn't get in any trouble. We had the Williams case coming up soon. It's a slam dunk. If you could have stayed out of trouble, I needed to testify. Now you've stolen this fucking book. Sorry, Jim. Come on, guy. I am what I am. Detective Jim Horton, he's like, okay, I'll talk to the judge. We'll probably make it easy on you. I need you for this case. This judge wanted Evans bad, wanted the book even worse. The judge, after analyzing the situation, made an offer of 27 months, and he wanted the book returned, this book of fucking birds. And Evans agreed to turn the book and himself in. Detective Jim Horton picked Gary up, relieved to have his witness secured for the upcoming murder trial of Jeffrey Williams, and everyone else happy just to get this book of fucking birds back. $100,000, Birds of America, a 60-pound book. Come on, guy. What, has it got actual birds in it? So Gary Evans, he wasn't happy, even though he'd made a sweet deal here. He was struggling bad this time in prison and didn't think he would make it through his stint as he was losing his mind and going downhill fast. I think mainly he was super paranoid that people were going to figure out that he was a rat on the Hell's Angels and a rat in other ways. I'm throwing the term rat around a lot here, and it's not really a real throwaway in the way in which I'm trying to put it across to everybody. He's a legitimate rat. Like, what a rat is, you know what a rat is? Like, the actual thing? A rat? A rat will do anything to save its own skin. It'll break its own bones to get out of, like, a small space. It'll chew through things. I mean, during Vietnam, didn't the Viet Cong, Charlie, fucking use rats against prisoners of war? They put them on their belly, strap a weave basket over top of the rat, and then the rat would eventually dig into the soldier's belly and get its way out through the flesh at the side of the fucking abdominal. Is that real? I don't know. I'm not sure. But that's what I think of when I think of a rat. It's a thief. You know, you can't trust a rat, the fucking animal. What are they, mammals? I don't know. I'm fucking an idiot, according to a lot of the fucking feedback I get. So he's a rat. He's killing people that he thinks will rat on him. And he's also killing these shop owners who could identify him. And he's ratting out on people in prison. He's doing anything he can to do to save his skin. He's a out-and-out rat. So Detective Horton just needed him to hang on until after the Williams trial. It took about 2 years until prosecutors were finally ready to call Gary Evans to the stand. It was May 16th, 1996. Showing up in an orange jumpsuit, chains and shackles clanging and in handcuffs, Gary Evans was on the stand for about half an hour. His testimony helped, and the jury handed down a guilty verdict, and Jeffrey Williams spent the rest of his life in prison. Afterwards, Detective Horton sat down with Gary and told him, "We're through now, Gary. No more. I can't do this any longer. You're too much of a fucking liability. I need to move on." And Gary Evans was quoted as saying to this, at that time, quote, "Okay, guy." Gary was released from prison on June the 6th of 1996 for the theft of the Birds of America book. He was 42 years old by this point, completely bald except for like that Hulk Hogan hair curtain at the back, but he was still in pretty good physical shape. He had been robbing people, homes, jewelry stores, antique shops for the past 25 years, killing people. Since 1977, he had been in and out of prison on average every 3 years. Along the way, he had murdered 4 people, possibly more. A career criminal, he had built his life around prison, killing people, and burglary. And he really, at this point now, had nothing to show for it. He had all kinds of eyes on him, and now he had Detective Horton saying, "I'm not going to help you with any fucking trouble you get into going on from here." Shortly after his release, he hooked back up with Tim Reisendorf. Throughout the winter of 1996 and the summer of 1997, Gary went on a burglarizing binge, and Tim accompanied him. Gary grew increasingly more paranoid of Tim and what he would do if they ever got caught. He had planned on killing Tim Reisendorf for a while because the police were getting closer and he felt that Reisendorf would have squealed on him in a second if they did get caught. And of course, he was still pissed about Reisendorf setting him up to kill Michael Falco. So on October the 3rd, 1997, Gary Evans met Reisendorf in the parking lot of a TJ Maxx in Latham. The plan was to drive to the spare room 2 storage facility where he and Tim both had rented units and go through the inventory that they had stolen, you know, over time. And that Tim was very sneaky. Tim was not getting arrested to this point, always kind of pulling out at the last second, being the guy to hold on to their stolen goods while Evans did all this prison time. "We need to part ways, Timmy," Evans said as they sat in Reisendorf's car outside of the facility with all their shit in the storage. "It's getting too hot with you around me. It's getting too hot for me to be around you." The idea was to split the merchandise and not see each other for a long while. After finishing splitting this merchandise, they drove to Lisa's apartment. Remember, Lisa's the wife of Cuomo, one of his victims. And they argue in the parking lot. He ends up finishing the argument, going back upstairs, banging Lisa. Lisa has no idea that she's with the killer of her child's father. Evans is arguing with Tim in this parking lot. They're talking about checks that need to be cashed. It's all sloppy. You know, they're going to get caught going at each other like this in the lot. By 6:30 p.m., they leave the parking lot, and the night wears on. They go back to Tim's apartment. Tim's girlfriend, Caroline Parker, she is the mother to Tim's son, Sean. They keep calling the apartment, asking when he's going to be home. He's dealing with Gary. Tim's getting pissed off their calls, so he eventually ends up calling her at 1 a.m. on October 4th and tells her, "You know what? I'll be home. I'll be over at your place in 40 minutes. When he's off the phone, Evans is like, "Fine, you know what? We're not going to figure this out. Let's just go back and do one more trip to the storage shed. We'll help each other load the rest of our shit, and that'll be absolutely it." Gary has his .22 caliber handgun tucked in the front of his pants, as he always did. Once they get to the storage shed, Tim's leaning down to pick up a box, and Gary Evans walks quietly up behind him and shoots him 3 times in the back of the head. Big surprise. With Tim Reisendorf lying down on the floor, Evans walks over to a box he put in the shed a few days earlier, pulls out a rubber bib, much like a butcher would wear, puts it on and takes out a chainsaw, starts it up, and proceeds to cut off Reisendorf's legs and arms in the storage shed. Gary had picked out a burial site in Brunswick days earlier. It was located up a steep hill, and the only way he can get Tim's body up the hill was to cut it up and bag it. After changing clothes and washing blood off his hands, he drove to a local supermarket, bought a bag of garbage bags and a gallon of bleach. As he chopped Tim's body into pieces, blood and bone fragments had sprayed all over, so he needed to clean this up. Once the cops figured out Tim was missing, they would likely track down the unit, so it had to be spotless. Gary taped up and bagged each body part and put them in a cardboard box along with the clothes he had worn while dismembering him. Then he began cleaning the walls and floor with the bleach and paper towels. The fumes at one point started to get to him, so he opened the door to the unit about 6 inches to get some fresh air. Remember, he's like in this parking lot, you know, with the storage units, like Storage Wars. He's in one of those fucking units. He hears footsteps. It's like a security guard or something coming up, he thinks. So he crawls to the door, and he's like, man, they must have heard the chainsaw fucking running. And he watches as some feet come walking up to the door. It turns out to be the manager of the storage unit facility. He grabs one of his guns, Gary Evans does, and points it at the door at eye level and waits for the door to raise. The manager does, in fact, put his hands under the bottom of the door. Gary sees this, and it's time to fucking kill somebody else until he hears another person yell out for the manager that he's needed back at the office. The hands disappear, and footsteps start to walk away. And Gary will later say, that is the luckiest motherfucker in the world. He had no idea how close he came to being buried next to Tim Reisendorf. That's the way it would have gone down. He, from that point, walks to TJ Maxx, gets in his truck, drives back to the storage unit, loads the box of body parts, his bloody clothes, and the chainsaw into his truck, waves goodbye to the manager on the way out. Before leaving, he drove to the chain-link fence that surrounded the storage facility and threw his .22 over the fence into a small ditch that ran along the interstate. He didn't want anything to do with that anymore. He'd killed enough people. He's probably going to turn the corner after this, he thinks. All his friends are dead. After burying Tim's body parts in several shallow graves just over the Troy city limits in Brunswick, Gary drives to a concrete plant located on the banks of the Hudson and throws the chainsaw and his clothes into the water. Covered in mud, he drives to Lisa's apartment, cleans himself up and has a glass of milk and a box of chocolate chip cookies, a sentimental snack from his younger years, begging from the window of his prison bedroom for the babysitter to bring him snacks, right? I thought that was a sweet, sweet touch. Just a big kid, eh? He goes to sleep. When he awakes, hours later, Gary packs his bag and takes off. On October 4th, 1997, Caroline, Tim Reisendorf's girlfriend, wakes up and realizes Tim's not home. She tries calling him, paging him, and for the next few hours paces her living room smoking. In her heart, she knows something's terribly wrong. This is not like Tim at all, and today was the day of her sister's wedding. He's supposed to be with her. Caroline calls her mother and tells her that Tim didn't come home last night. He's missing. I can't find him. She tells her mom not to tell the family if she didn't want to spoil the day for her sister. After putting the finishing touches on her makeup for the day, the phone rings. She almost jumps out of her skin. She knows it's bad news. Gary Evans, claiming to be a friend of Tim's named Lou, tells Caroline he's concerned her husband has run off. Then he hangs up. Before leaving for the wedding, Caroline calls the Saratoga Springs Police Department and asks if they could find out if Timothy had been in an auto accident or arrested, or is he just dead in this apartment? They do look into it, but they find nothing. Detective Horton's last encounter with Gary Evans was back in 1995, and they hadn't spoken since. As Detective Horton and Charles Sully Sullivan made their way over to Caroline's apartment to begin trying to find out what had happened to Tim Reisendorf, they had no reason to believe it was anything more than a cheating husband who ran off on his family. They asked her a lot of questions about her and Tim's relationship and asked if she knew if he had any other girlfriends. Has anything changed recently? His attitude? His demeanor? How did you two get along? Well, we're fine, and there's no other girlfriends, but there is a kind of a boyfriend Tim grew up with, and Troy, who he's been hanging around a lot with lately. I don't like him. I don't trust him. Do you know what his name is? Asked Detective Horton. Trying to think of his name, she said, I know he's suspected of killing another guy Tim knows, Michael Falco. Detective Horton's like, what the fuck? There's no way Gary's back in my life here. He says, is his name Gary Evans? Does that name mean anything to you, the name Gary Evans? Yeah, that's the guy. Tim's been hanging around with that Gary guy lately. I don't like him. If there was any doubt in Detective Horton's mind that Cuomo and Falco were dead at the hands of Gary Evans, it was wiped away here. Detective Horton had one of his investigators search a visitors list, visitors who had come to the federal prison to see Gary during his recent stay. What turned out to be a joke around the office was when the list came back, Detective Horton's name was at the top of that list. While everyone laughed, there was noticed a name that was familiar on that list. Lisa Morris, the girlfriend to the now deceased, though they don't know it yet. Damian Cuomo, another associate of Gary Evans. This woman who was having sex with Gary ultimately would end up breaking the Tim Reisendorf missing person case wide open. Detective Horton was able to locate her on October 15th, 1997, goes to talk to her. He's talked about you, she says to Horton. I've heard your name before, detective. Within minutes, Horton learned that he and Lisa had more in common than Evans. Their daughters attended the same school. Even more remarkable to him was the fact that the father of her daughter, Christina, was Damian Cuomo. Small world. Lisa had truly believed that Damian Cuomo had taken off on her and their daughter, Christina, and he was nothing but a deadbeat dad living in the Carolinas somewhere. That's what Gary had told her. I need to talk to Gary, Detective Horton told Lisa. She confessed that she and Gary had been dating on and off for the past 8 years. Lisa talked about Gary as if he were some kind of Prince Charming who had saved her from the mess that Damian Cuomo had left them in. In May of 1998, while Lisa was having a beer at her favorite local watering hole, the barmaid took a call from a guy named Lou Murray, who asked to speak to Lisa. Of course, this was Gary Evans. He told Lisa that he had been traveling and was in Alaska working on a fishing boat. He also told her he would be returning to Albany soon. Lisa relayed this to Detective Horton. Gary Evans contacted Lisa this way a few more times and told her he needed her car to do a job in Vermont and talked about meeting her there. Detective Horton learned about this and started planning his trap. He put together a team and got permission to go out of state. He couldn't be part of the setup and needed undercover cops. Evans wouldn't know. Gary Evans had planned to meet Lisa at a McDonald's in St. Jonesbury. The setup was soon in place with no detail overlooked. Gary Evans was a professional thief, and now Horton knew he was a professional killer. He was one who hated cops and hated the thought of being locked up. He hated anyone who stood in the way of his freedom by this point. He even hated Detective Horton. Detective Horton told his men to take Gary Evans alive, if possible. He had a lot of questions for him. He's moved up in the ranks here, and along the way, he had become almost friends with Gary Evans. He knew this criminal more than he knew any other criminal. On the day of the sting, Gary Evans showed up riding his bike, stopping directly across from the McDonald's, where he was to meet Lisa and get her car. He walked a few yards over to a monument and sat down. One by one, each investigator on the case emerged from their undercover positions and began to move in on Gary. He didn't have a clue until he felt everyone close in on him. He leapt off the monument and took a few steps heading to the woods behind the McDonald's. As he bolted across the street, the canine cop released his dog, a large German shepherd trained to attack, who took one leap and sank his teeth into Evans's calf. Gary fell and tried to fight off the dog, and within seconds, every investigator tackled him. Just as quickly, guns were drawn, pointing at his head. Detective Horton had warned everyone about Gary's trick of hiding handcuff keys all over his body. The only way to monitor his behavior at all times was to strip him naked. So they did. Handcuffed him. Good thing he was buff as shit, though, so he didn't mind swinging that dick around and flexing those thighs, those little nipples below those long locks of his. I'm getting a little... It's getting hot in here. Evans didn't say a word to anyone as he was taken into custody. And after he was processed and fingerprinted, he finally said, Jim Horton. I'll only speak to Detective Jim Horton. For Gary, there would be no more deals, no more snacks of cookies and milk, no more trading information for prison time, no more freedom. Gary confessed to the murders in detail and revealed where Cuomo and Reisendorf's bodies were buried. Investigators were sent to Florida, where they located the body of Michael Falco, right where Evans told them it would be. On August 12, 1998, he was arraigned and formally charged with the murders of Michael Falco, Damian Cuomo, and Tim Reisendorf. On August 14, 1998, he had a parole hearing scheduled in Albany. Armed marshals escorted Evans to a light brown Chevrolet Astro van that the United States Marshal Service used routinely as a prisoner transport vehicle. Dressed in an orange jumpsuit, Evans was handcuffed at his wrists and shackled at his ankles, but the USMS didn't see the need for an additional waist chain. Even more surprising, Gary Evans was not scanned with a metal detector to see if he was hiding contraband. A second vehicle carrying two additional armed marshals would follow. Inside the van, plexiglass separated Evans from the officers up front. He was alone in the back. The only thing separating Evans from the outside were the rear windows of the van made of half-inch glass, no different from the glass Chevrolet puts in all of its vans. Gary was calm as the van began its journey to the U.S. District Court in Albany. At 10:16 a.m., he was signed into the Albany Court, and by 10:30, he had been advised of his sentence for violating the terms of his parole. He was passive, non-responsive, and unfocused. At 10:38 a.m., he was loaded into the back for his trip back to the county jail a 10-minute drive up Interstate 787 and over the Troy Menands Bridge. For the second time, he was not scanned. By 11 a.m., witness Kevin Cott was traveling east over the Troy Menands Bridge in the far right lane. In his side view mirror, he noticed a nondescript Astro van coming up from behind him in the left lane. As the van passed his vehicle, a spray of what Cott initially thought were sand pebbles began bouncing off his windshield. Those turned out to be shards of glass pelting his windshield. He watched as the van locked its brakes and slid sideways into his lane, and then saw an orange jumpsuit coming out of the side window. Gary Evans had kicked out the window and was climbing out, while the van was still squealing to a stop. The van was about three-quarters of the way across the bridge at this point. Gary Evans took a headfirst dive onto the pavement, rolled a few times, then was up on his feet, bleeding. The marshals in the van and the vehicle following them jumped out and headed Gary Evans off, and he soon found himself cornered on the bridge. There was no way out. With the thought of being locked up for life, Gary crawled under the outer guardrail, and with 62 feet between him and the water, he jumped. Chaos ensued at the bridge as cops, U.S. Marshals, fire trucks, rescue personnel, and media rushed to the scene. Below the bridge, near the Troy side, Evans lay in about 12 inches of water, 10 feet from the shore. When Detective Horton received word about the escape, his first thought was, quote, "I fucking knew it." Gary Charles Evans, his face bloody from the incredible fall and jumping out of the van and landing on his fucking head, lay face up in the water. He was dead. There were contusions and bruises on the right side of his head. It was determined that he had landed on a piece of rebar, which had actually really killed him. One Dr. Barbara Wolf decided the cause of death was blunt force injuries to the head and torso with skull fracture, the result from a jump from a bridge. All that twisted American steel that made up the frame of the so-called Great Tricep King. That name given to him by David Berkowitz, the son of Sam. All that twisted American steel that made him up couldn't withstand a blow from a piece of the real thing. American rebar. Speaking of bar, Detective Horton couldn't help but feel a tinge of regret in how the story of Gary Evans ended. When Horton had arrived at the scene, he noticed Evans had two sets of handcuffs on his wrists. After closer inspection, one set of cuffs that were attached were from the Troy Police Department, and the other set, with one cuff dangling, were from the USMS. He's like, what the hell? How did he get both these sets of cuffs off of him? It was important to Detective Horton to be present at Gary's autopsy. Almost immediately, they discovered clues of that autopsy as to how far Gary would go to carry out his plan to escape. At his Achilles heel, they found a paperclip and a razor blade taped to his skin under his sock. A quick search before he got into the vehicle would have found this shit easily. After a full body x-ray, they found buried in Gary Evans's left nostril inside his sinus a handcuff key. A lot began to make sense to Horton at this autopsy. The set of dangling handcuffs, clearly he was grabbing the key from his nostril with a long pinky fingernail that he had noticed Evans had been growing all the time. And he thought it was for scooping cocaine, but he never did drugs. This pinky fingernail was for him to use to drag a handcuff key out from his nostril when he needed it. That sneaky son of a bitch, Detective Horton thought. And to that, Gary Evans likely would have countered, I can't deny that, guy. Detective Horton heard a local bar was offering a drink dedicated to his unlikely friend after his incredible death, where he jumped off of a bridge rather than be arrested. Detective Horton decided to go have one of these drinks dedicated to Gary Evans. It was a vodka and cranberry juice on ice that the bar had named, quote, Gary on the Rocks. And that'll do it. That was one that I've been kind of hesitant to cover for quite some time. I've always enjoyed the story of Gary Charles Evans, and I say always because I've been looking at this case since I started Dark Topic, but just never really knew how I'd go about covering it because it was long and a lot of it about just his burglaries and a word I can't say, really, fucking burglaries. But there's a lot of things about him that I admire, and I think that's the product of me growing up around some criminals. not admire. Fuck. I mean, it just reminds me of some guys that I used to know. Not that I'm anywhere near like fucking as cool as like a Gary Charles. No, I mean, not that any of the people that I've been around, I think did great things. But he just reminds me of some people. And I wanted to tell it. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without help from my mother-in-law, who did the research on this, read the book. I read the book as well by, who's it by? Oh, Michael William Phelps, Every Move You Make. I mean, you should read the book, but you don't really need to. I kind of just read it to you. That's a long episode. And eyes cocked, doors locked, stay paranoid till next time. That was a little bit different. Once in a while, I like to do like the bank robber style guys, the burglarers, and that was one of them. Although he did kill some people in cold blood there for sure, but it is a little bit different of a style for me, and it's just a once in a while thing. I'll go that deep on somebody like that. Was he really even that interesting? I guess not. But the interest that I found in it is that I can count a few guys that I know that were just like that. Didn't go that hard, but were just kind of like that, where they thought that their only hope in the world to gain big was to steal and rob, and they tried to be stand-up guys, you know, thought they were bikers, thought they were mob guys, but quickly showed they weren't when they got pressed. Regular guys acting like they're something that they aren't and finding themselves somewhere in between. Relatable if you have criminals in your life. I'll say that, I guess. A lot of us could have had an Uncle Gary, I feel. And I'll get crucified, of course, if I don't say that there's empathy that needs to be had for the victims. Okay, so there you go. I said it. I do. Throughout, I spend time with that. But, I mean, if you're going to fucking get at me on that, go feel empathy for the victims yourself. Go visit their grave sites. I mean, are you that fucking great? You want me just to say it? I said it. You think I mean it? Probably not. I do. I'm just not going to spend a lot of time on it because it's pandering. Every time someone gets killed in one of these stories, you got to feel empathy for them. I just focus on the fucking perpetrator most of the time. So, you know, sue me. So I'm going to be releasing my dark fiction on October the 2nd. That'll be a couple of Thursdays from now for spooky season. I've already released this to the 13th floor of Patreon. The plan was to sell this as a book, my book of short stories. It's about 3 hours long. I did an audio version of it. It's 13 stories that I've written over the last 3 years and done on the 13th floor of Patreon and some on Apple Plus. The plan was to sell this on Audible, and I had something worked out, but it suddenly just didn't start feeling right, and I'm writing a novel. And that's what I want to attempt to sell to you in the future. You as my base audience for it when I try to become an author and have a jumping off point here with Dark Topic. I've tried to be published a few times in the past, never had an opportunity, never was accepted. And now that I have an audience, I think that I have an opportunity to make some noise when I have the right thing, when I have the right thing that I've written. And I think the right thing will be this novel that I'm working on that is about my life and about my dad and it's about a lot of things, but it's a horror story. It's kind of similar to like a Dean Koontz or a Stephen King or a John Saul or a Peter Straub or a Robert McCammon, or, you know, style offering. Horror fiction. I'm gonna wait to try to sell something when it comes to that, when I finish my first novel. This book of short stories, I'm going to put out for everybody for free, publicly, on October 2nd. Couple Thursdays from now. So look forward to that. Jack Luna's Dark Fiction. 13 short stories from the mind of Jack Luna. All right. And truly, thank you for listening. And if you want to support and get additionals, exclusives, go to Patreon, go to Spotify, go to Apple Plus, in the show notes. And until next time, keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, and stay paranoid. And talk at you real soon. Hope you enjoyed. A little bit tired. Not much else to say. What do I say? I don't know. Bye. Right? Fuck, I've said enough. Christ, I've been talking for like 2 hours here. Big love, everybody. Take care of yourselves. And if you don't feel like taking care of yourself, well then, take care of the ones you love through taking care of yourself.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.